teacher. And so when you see a well-dressed Japanese girl, her kimono hangs a little bit down the back like this, exposing her neck. They pay no attention, though, to breasts, which seem to so fascinate the American male. That it just doesn't seem to appear. And the way that a traditional Japanese woman clothes herself is exposing the neck, but looking very flat in front, and not at all showing the hips. She's willowy. She doesn't look very willowy underneath, as a rule, but she does when dressed in a kimono. Now, so you see, it isn't just that nature has built in to the human organism certain attractive features about other people. It's the social institution of what is to be attractive. And of course this comes out very, very strongly in the vagaries of fashion and how to do one's hair, paint one's face, etc., etc. But now, social institutions go a great deal deeper than anything we've mentioned. And the most important kind of social institution is that which has to do with role-playing. Who you are. Now, when we ask the question, who are you? People think of this question in two different ways. One person, when asked, who are you, will answer, I'm a doctor. Another person will fall silent because he realizes how profound the question is. He realizes that he's been asked what his ego is. But a lot of people don't realize that when they are asked, who are you? I have noticed just a little bit of difficulty in my investigations of discussing identity. Way of going about things, this method of Zen, that has so fascinated the West. And everybody who reads about Zen wonders if somehow, you see, this understanding is right under your nose. You know how it is, sometimes you get a crowd of people to come into a room, and you put something in the room that's absurd. Like suppose there was a balloon floating on the ceiling. People could come in and not notice it at all. Or, you know, somebody puts on something weird, some kind of a funny necktie or something. And you say to a person, well, haven't you noticed? A woman in a new dress, you know? Haven't you noticed? I said, well, no, what is it? What? You know, it's right under your nose. They're staring you in the face, but you don't see it. And Zen is exactly like that. It is very obvious. The master prostrate themselves. Because and you know what the reason for all that is, that nobody is more frightened of everybody else than a tyrant. He sits with his back to the wall, and his guards on either side of him. And he has you face downwards on the ground because you can't use weapons that way. When you come into his presence, you don't stand up and face him because you might attack. And he has reason to fear that you might because he's ruling you all. And the man who rules you all is the biggest crook in the bunch. Because he's the one who's succeeded in crime. The other people are pushed aside because the criminals, the people we lock up in jail, are simply the people who didn't make it. So naturally, the real boss sits with his back to the wall and his henchmen on either side of him. And so when you design a church, what does it look like? Catholic church with the altar as it used to be. It's changing now because of the Catholic. Good. Now, you have found the frontier gate to Zen. You've put your foot in at the door, and you're across the threshold. But there's a long way to go. And now you have found this priceless thing out, you must redouble your efforts. So he gives him another koan. Now the student may be able to answer that one instantly, because it's simply a test koan. See, there are five classes of koans. The first class is what you call the Hinayana koans, and the other four are the Mahayana koans. Hinayana is to reach nirvana. Mahayana is to come back and bring nirvana into the world as a bodhisattva. So once you get the great void, you see, there's nothing to catch on to. You are the universe. It doesn't matter whether you live or die. We, each one of us, are something that the whole realm of being is doing. We feel that we are something that has come into the whole realm of being as a stranger. When we were born, we don't really know where we came from, because we don't remember. And we think when we die, that's just going to be that. Some people console themselves with the idea that they're going to heaven, or that they're going to be reincarnated, or they're going to some...
another 4,320,000 years, and then it vanishes, and it does it again. And it does it, and does it, and does it, and does it, and there is no end to this. But fortunately, because of the forgettery, every 4,320,000 years, it doesn't become a totally insufferable bore. There is this blank space, this trough between the crests of the waves. You see? Now, the Hindus thought about that. And they got tired. And they thought about the possibility of moksha, liberation, or nirvana, from the everlasting cycle of appearing and disappearing. But then when they had thought that through, the Buddhists, for example, having really said, now we've got the trick. As the Buddha said after his enlightenment, now I've found you out, you who build the house. I'm going to take the house apart. The roof beam is brought down. Desire is the builder of the house. See, I've found you. Never again shall you
build. Human face, they use a flower or a star. The rose window, the lotus. When I think what I want, you know, I try sometimes to figure out, you know, what I would really like to have. What I like to look at. I eventually settle for a flower. It's why they bring flowers to sick people in hospitals. Because love hurts. But on the other hand, a weaving of smoke can be very beautiful. Provided you don't lean on it. Provided you don't try to preserve it. Catch hold of it. Then you destroy it. So exactly the same way, there's nothing in the way of form that you can lean on, that you can grasp. And if you see that, then the world of form is very beautiful. If you let it go, to love people, you see, if you're a husband and wife, you must let each other go. Otherwise, the marriage is either going to break up or it's going to be hell. If you love a person, you say to that person, look, I love you, whatever that may be. I've seen quite a bit of it, and I know there's lots that I haven't seen. But still, it's you, and I want you to be what you want to be. And I won't be happy if I've got you in a cage. But what is a non-god? A non-god is an inconceivable something or other. I love the story about a debate in the Houses of Parliament in England, when, as you know, the Church of England is established and therefore under the control of the government. And the high ecclesiastics had petitioned Parliament to let them have a new prayer book. And somebody got up and said, it's perfectly ridiculous that Parliament should decide upon this because, as we well know, there are quite a number of atheists in these benches. And somebody got up and he said, oh, I don't think there are really any atheists here. We all believe in some sort of a something somewhere. Now, again, of course, it isn't that some Buddhism believes in some sort of a something somewhere. And that is to say, in vagueness. To say, you is what the whole thing is doing. But you see, we forget it. We don't know. We've been brought up in a special way so that we are unaware of the connection, unaware that each one of us is the works.
There is but one God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, etc. And they make jokes about the Protestants and say they don't have real authority in Protestant church because everybody interprets the Bible according to his own opinion. But we have an authoritative interpretation of the Bible. But this always screens out the fact that it is fundamentally a matter of your own opinion that you accept the authority of the church to interpret the Bible. You cannot escape in all matters of belief from opinion. In other words, it must become clear to you that you yourself create all the authorities you accept. And if you create them in order to dissimulate, in order to pretend that your motivations and your character are different, that you would like them to be different, this is the same old...
Oneness has an opposite, and the Brahman has no opposite. What do you think he said? He said, you argue just like a Hindu. Well, he knew very well. I mean, he was using loose language, and as we all do. So, this was the thing, you see, historically, in the development of Indian philosophy that took place between about 100 and 400 AD, that they faced the fact that looking for a state of consciousness that's radically different from this state now is just an escape. It hasn't really come to terms with the problem. The problem is, you see, that the state of consciousness you're in now, however loused up it may be, is in Hindu language the play of Vishnu. You are all Vishnu playing that you're in this mess, which is the part of the cosmic dance. So, if that's the case, dig it. You see? I mean, get with it. Be that. So, the Chinese caught on to this. And when you could say, this very moment, this very world, this very body is the point. Now. But if you see you're seeking something beyond all the time, you never get with it. You're never here. So they saw that very clearly. So this man, Sun San, who I was talking about at the end of this morning's session, who...
To proceed to the knowledge of God, it is necessary to go by the way of remotion, of saying what God is not, since God by his immensity exceeds every conception to which our intellect can attain. So then, when of the Godhead the Hindu says, all that can truly be said is neti, neti, not this, not this, and when the Buddhist uses such a term for the final reality as shunyata, which means voidness or emptiness, then textbook after textbook on comparative religion that I've read by various theologians say, this is terrible negativism. This is nihilism. But he doesn't realize that it's nothing of the kind. If, for example, you have a window on which there's a fine painting of the sun, your act of faith in the real sun will be to scrape that off so that you can let the real sunlight in.
10 teeth. She has a scimitar in one hand and a severed head in the other. And she is trampling on the body of her husband, who is Shiva. Shiva represents also, furthermore, the destructive aspect of the deity. wherein all things are dissolved so that they be reborn again. And here is this blood-sucking, terrible mother as the image of the supreme reality behind this universe. Imagine, it's the representative of the octopus, the spider, the awful awfuls, the creepy crawlies at the end of the line, which we are all terrified of. Now that's a very important image, because let us suppose, just for the sake of argument, that all of you sitting here right now are feeling fairly all right. I mean, you're not in hospital. You don't have the screaming mean chances that have got mixed up somehow. Then this very opinion that you're expressing, you see, is a function of that nervous system. So you're saying that you are a total hoax. You can't trust yourself at all. So that is a set of game rules that don't lead anywhere. It's totally self-frustrating. So you see, what the Chinese have developed here is a theory of nature. I said there are three theories. The Western mechanical theory, nature as an artifact, the Hindu dramatic theory, and the Chinese organic theory. Nature, human nature included, is an organism. And an organism is a system of orderly anarchy. There is no boss in it, but it gets along by being left alone and being allowed...
I'm trying to become as deeply attached as I can to as many people and things as possible. So what I'm pointing out to you is that this basic seeing that it's all da, 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 provides a possibility for you to become involved in it much more incautiously than you normally are. To express feeling, to love, to throw yourself at the mercy of the goings-on completely, you see? So that this very perception of the illusion makes it possible to live up the illusion. And so if someone, therefore, is always in his attitude to life detached and reserved, it indicates, you see, that there's still a primordial fear of getting involved.
Doing various chores as a sort of janitor when you begin in sword school, and will take every possible occasion to surprise you and hitting you with a bamboo sword. And you're expected to defend yourself with anything available, with the cushion, with a broom, with a saucepan, anything you happen to be handling, defend yourself immediately. Well, after a while, you know, if you're going around your everyday work expecting to be jumped on any minute, it becomes rather nerve-wracking. Especially if you're thinking all the time about where's it going to come from next. And you discover that the more you make plans and try to calculate on where it's going to hit you next, you will always be outwitted, because the teacher is infinitely clever and will always come from an unexpected direction. So at last there arrives a point where you just give up. You stop planning. And you just go around relaxed, and if it hits it...
Zen has a very different flavor from modern Japanese Zen. And so, of course, many of the people who go to study Zen in Japan disapprove of Dr. Suzuki thoroughly. And also, naturally, of my exposition of Zen, because we don't make a great fetish of studying Zen by sitting. In Japan today, they sit and they sit and they sit. R.H. Blythe asked a Zen master, what would you do if you had only 1 half hour left to live? And he said, I would do Zazen, which means he would sit like a Buddha here and practice meditation. And Blythe had given him several choices. Would you like to listen to your favorite music? Would you have a dinner? Would you get drunk? Would you like the company of a beautiful woman? Would you take a walk? What would you do? Or would you just go on with your daily business as if nothing was going to happen? In other words, would you wind up your watch? So he was very disappointed in this answer.
And in that silence, you suddenly begin to see the world as it is. And you don't see any past, and you don't see any future. You don't see any difference between yourself and the rest of it. That's just an idea. You can't put your hand on the difference between myself and you. You know, you can't blow it, you can't bounce it, you can't pull it. It's just an
intended to produce what I would call metaphysical laughter. But this has to be a surprise. And so as to be surprised, well, there's no way of premeditating it. So you see, if you read, for example, there's a book out here called Zen by Eugen Herigel, who studied archery. Many of you have probably read this book. And you're using the right means, but because you're using them for a selfish intent, or a fearful intent, you're afraid of suffering and you don't like it and you want to get out of it, you want to escape. All these, you see, are the motivations which frustrate the right means. So one is meant to find that out. And so then, in course of...
I want to make it perfectly plain before I go any further that in talking about these two great religious traditions, in terms of images, I am talking about the way they express themselves at a rather popular level. Sophisticated Christians and sophisticated Hindus think beyond images. For example, a Christian may think of God as the Father, but a sophisticated and educated Christian does not imagine that God is a cosmic male parent with a white beard sitting on a golden throne above the stars. Nor does a Hindu imagine literally that God is the super showman, the big actor. These images are what it is like, not what it is. And perhaps when I get through with discussing them, we'll be able to ask the question as to whether any of these images still make sense to us in this...
We've left out of our logic, and this is part of the game rule of the game that we are playing. The way we hoodwink ourselves is by attributing powerlessness to nothingness. We don't realize that is a complete logical fallacy. On the contrary, it takes nothing to have something. Because you wouldn't know what something was without nothing. You wouldn't know what the form is without the background space. You wouldn't be able to see anything unless there were nothing behind your eyes. Now imagine yourself with a spherical eye. You can see all around. But now what's in the middle? See? Even if I have all this behind me in view, suddenly I will find that there is something in the middle of it all. There's a hole in the middle of reality. Like now, there seems to be not so much a hole but a wall, but any animal.
But if the satisfaction of biological urges is to mean anything, surely the point of these urges is not the fatuous one of mere survival, of, we might say, the point of the individual is simply that he contributes to the welfare of the race.